This is the son of PCJ.
Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. Coming up on this edition, Peter O'Neill voted as Papua New Guinea's prime minister. Nepal has called for fresh elections after a constitutional failure. Australia and Thailand celebrate 60 years of diplomatic relations. We have this and much more, so stay tuned. This is Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. Members of Parliament in Papua New Guinea have voted Peter O'Neill in as Prime Minister. The acting Governor-General, Geoffrey Nappi, had earlier suspended the ceremony, saying he wanted to study the official documents. After a three-hour wait, Mr. O'Neill was officially made PNG's new leader after being elected to the role unopposed during the vote in Parliament House. Mr. O'Neill's supporters are hoping that the result will bring an end to the power struggle with his predecessor, Sir Michael Somare. Radio Australia's Liam Fox has this report from Papua New Guinea.
The day began in Parliament with a vote to elect a new Prime Minister. Peter O'Neill was the only nominee and won the vote 56-0.
I now declare the member for Yalgupangia, Mr. Peter O'Neill, has been elected as Prime Minister-elect of the independent state of Papua New Guinea.
Then the Prime Minister-elect came here to Government House to be officially sworn in. Normally, it's a mere formality, but the acting Governor-General, Geoffrey Nape, suspended the ceremony, saying he wanted to study the official documents. 3 hours later, Peter O'Neill was officially sworn in as PNG's Prime Minister.
I hope this is the last of the saga that we are continuing. I hope both our leading citizens in the community, in judiciary or members of Parliament, to take note of the decision of Parliament and respect the Parliament's wishes.
No doubt his rival, Sir Michael Somare, and his supporters will say what happened here today is unconstitutional. Ordinary Papua New Guineans, meanwhile, are sick and tired of this leadership dispute and are looking forward to going to the general election next month.
That was Liam Fox reporting from Papua New Guinea. Nepal's prime minister has called fresh elections after efforts to form a new constitution failed. The prime minister made the announcement in a televised address as the deadline for the agreement on the charter passed. The Maoist government wishes to use the constitution to create a new secular, democratic republic. The Maoist government wishes to use the constitution to create a new secular, democratic society, following the abolishment of the centuries-old Hindu monarchy in 2008. But disagreement with rival parties has led to a breakdown in talks. Bill Bainbridge speaks to Chitwa Tiwari, a Nepalese specialist.
The issue hinges on the issue of federalism. Actually, this Constituent Assembly was supposed to, finish its job in 2 years. They didn't do it because of the, infighting between different, conniving politicians, political party leaders. And now they had sorted out, several things, but they failed to sort out on the issue of federalism. Nepal, is a country where you have got more than 100 ethnic communities. And it's a country of minority groups. But they were trying to carve out the country with about, 10, 11, or maybe 14 provinces or states. There was the main problem.
And so were these provinces, are these provinces to be divided along ethnic lines?
Along ethnic lines, giving the particular name based on one ethnic community. So people really, didn't like that idea. So there was a massive, opposition to this concept. People were, demanding that it should be identity-based, acceptable to all, rather than in the name of one particular, ethnic community. So they failed to agree on this issue, and ultimately that led to the collapse of Constituent Assembly. And the Prime Minister has recommended that a new constitution, the election be held within the 6 months period, but the president has not responded as of now. As I speak to you, I have no idea. They are still sleeping in Nepal at this time.
So the president will need to approve this. Is it likely that he will approve it, or he'll push it back onto the politicians to try and come up with a compromise solution?
He might do both. He might try both ways because right after the prime minister, exited from the presidential office, the other political parties who are opposed to the election, they went to the president's office to tell the president that they are against this announcement, that the prime minister's announcement is unconstitutional. That is what they are claiming. So president might be taking advice from several of his legal experts.
So even if new elections were held, do you think that they're likely to achieve any kind of resolution to this issue? Or will the same issues be there? Will we just see a repeat of the current events?
No, I think it will be the repeat of the same thing. But again, now all political parties have lost their status in the parliament, in the constituent assembly, because no one is there now. At least, the Maoist party had the right to claim itself as the largest party in the constituent assembly. But now with the dissolution of constituent assembly, no party can claim as the largest party. That being the case, we don't know what kind of parliament or constituent assembly will emerge in 6 months of time. So the issue of this ethnic identity is becoming very, very touchy there. So it might even lead to, I suspect it might lead to a civil war in their country, a very bloody, civil war, which I don't want to see it, but then the things are heading towards that direction.
You say a civil war. Who would be the likely combatants in any civil war? Will we see the old groupings that have had so much conflict in Nepal over the years? Will they reemerge, or are you talking about new groups?
About new groups. In the past, when there was insurgency, it was basically between the Maoist and the royal forces. At that time, ideology was at the forefront. But now in Nepal, ideology is dead. Political parties have miserably failed. And the result is that we have ethnic politics raising its ugly head.
And how have the Nepalese public reacted to these events? Are they hoping to see a resolution to this, or are people becoming entrenched in these ethnic identities and really preparing themselves for conflict?
Well, until about a year ago, people had mixed feeling. They were expecting that something good will come out of the assembly. But the assembly never got its chance, to sit in full house. Everything was discussed outside of the assembly building, at political party offices, political party leaders' houses, and in some distant, resorts. So the assembly was basically a rubber stamp type of institution there. It was made of a big laughing stock, and now it's gone. So probably, people who did not like to see the constituent assembly, enjoying their, they have a day now. But any conflict in the future is going to be multifaceted. It's not like the previous conflict where only two sides were fighting. But now there will be various forces, fighting against each other. It would be very much like the, events in Somalia or even Rwanda.
And so just finally, there have been reports of protests outside Parliament already and the use of tear gas by police. Are you expecting violence to break out anytime soon?
It could. If the violence breaks out, I would not be surprised. I read the reports of that, small violence outside of the Parliament building because... the opponents of ethnic state were there, and at the same time, the supporters of ethnic state were there. So, the police who was trying to be in the middle, in order to avoid the clash.
The leaders of Australia and Thailand have met in Canberra to mark the 60th anniversary of diplomatic relations between the two countries. Prime Minister Julia Gillard and Yingluck Shinawatra acknowledged a special link as the first prime ministers of their respective countries. As well as enhanced economic ties, they planned to promote the political and economic empowerment of women and girls throughout the new political exchange program. The visit comes as Thai politics once again threatened to become polarized over Ms. Yingluck's brother and former prime minister, Thaksin Shinawatra. Karen Snowden has more.
There were compliments in Canberra.
It's always special to welcome the leader of a nation that calls Australia a friend, but it is especially significant as my nation's first female Prime Minister to welcome Your Excellency as Thailand's first female Prime Minister.
And in Sydney, the Thai Prime Minister reciprocated.
From a partner in development to a major trade and investment partner, Australia has developed close the relation with Thailand and Southeast Asia, and this has become more comprehensive and dynamic.
But later, the main message to an Asia Society and Australia-Thai Business Council dinner was that Thailand has recovered from last year's devastating floods and is a good place to invest in.
And for this year, our economy is expected to grow strongly at 5.5 to 6.5%. We think that we are located at the heart of Mekong regions and the ASEAN communities of 600 million consumers.
Thailand has made a good recovery from the zero growth of last year after floods destroyed much of the manufacturing base of its exports. But now the spectre of Europe's problems loom large over an economy dependent on exports for much of its GDP growth. Official figures released as the Thai and Australian prime ministers met showed a surprise fall of almost 4% for April's exports, when an increase of 3% was expected. On the plus side, the government intends to spend $74 billion on infrastructure over the next 5 years and is cutting the corporate tax rate to 20% next year. Yingluck Shinawatra is in Australia to promote Thai food and agriculture and deepen well-established bilateral ties in regional organisations and security and counter-terrorism cooperation.
Thailand is ready to further support the Thailand-Australia partnership.
The visit has been welcomed by the President of the Australia-Thai Business Council, Tamerlane Beasley.
Oh, it's a great demonstration of the commitment of Thailand to Australia business collaboration, and it's really exciting to see we have some of Thailand's biggest investors here as part of the business delegation and some of Australia's biggest investors in Thailand as well.
Coinciding with the Prime Minister's visit to Australia, the Thai and Burmese governments announced the Burmese President, Thein Sein, has postponed his planned visit to Bangkok for a week. He was to attend the World Economic Forum on East Asia, which has extended an invitation to opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi, who will attend. It will be her first foreign trip in two decades. Also this week in Thailand, more debate is due in Parliament on the so-called Amnesty Bill, a wide-ranging and vague document aimed at granting amnesty to all participants in political upheaval prior to the elections in 2011. It's widely seen by opposition parties as a means of granting a pardon to the Prime Minister's brother and former PM, Thaksin Shinawatra, and to allow his eventual return to Thailand. It risks a return to political instability that has taken years to overcome. For Australian business leader Tamerlane Beasley, though, Thailand remains a good investment destination.
In terms of the business relationship, we find business tends to tick on, basically. The political changes in Thailand haven't had a huge impact on Australian business. A lot of Australian investors, for example, are investing in the eastern seaboard in manufacturing, which just basically keeps going, regardless of what happens in the political situation. So it hasn't had a huge impact.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our email address is pcj@pcjmedia.com. We'd love to hear your stories and suggestions. Despite recent signs that its economy might be slowing down, China could soon end up buying more raw materials from Australia if measures flagged to Trade Minister Craig Emerson come to pass. In meetings with Chinese economic ministers in Beijing, Dr. Emerson said he's been told that the Chinese government will not allow the country's economy to slow down much further. That's led to speculation in China that a new round of infrastructure and other stimulus programs are being prepared, which could increase demand for Australia raw iron or coal and gas. Stephen McDonald from Beijing has the story.
As heavy hitters go in China's economic sphere, they don't come more senior than Commerce Minister Chen Deming, Economic Vice Premier Wang Qishan, and Zhang Ping from the National Development and Reform Commission. Trade Minister Craig Emerson has just met them all in Beijing, and the message he received is that China is preparing to act. When Dr. Emerson spoke to reporters, he was asked about recent figures showing some slowing in Chinese economic activity. He responded that the government here says it won't let growth drop much further.
In my meetings, it was clear that, as has happened in the past, if there are real shocks, and I accept John's point that already there are, you know, there's softness in the data, that the Chinese authorities will take accommodative steps to deal with those shocks.
But they said that to you.
Mm.
If there are problems, we will take what steps that are necessary to...
We will sustain a, these are my words, but, you know, a healthy growth rate.
Many analysts here say that China is preparing a new round of stimulus measures. The government responded to the 2008 crisis with an $800 billion package. Huge infrastructure projects were brought forward, low-cost housing was built, and the car industry got a shot in the arm. The more China develops its infrastructure, the more it needs Australian raw materials, including coal, gas, and especially iron ore. Dr. Emerson was not told the details of any new measures, but they would clearly be designed to counter any collapse in demand from Europe.
No one is a soothsayer about the future course that Europe might take, but as occurred during the depths of the global financial crisis, which became the deepest global recession since the Great Depression, the Chinese authorities lifted their domestic stimulus to counteract the shockwaves that were coming from the rest of the world. That has been the practice, and I think it will be the sort of approach that is adopted again.
And so do you think that's a sort of sustainable approach in the long run?
Well, I think it is, because the pattern of economic growth in this country is, in any event, being shifted towards domestic consumption as a driver of growth. And so the dependence on net exports is falling as we speak.
The Trade Minister says his government is not starry-eyed about global economic prospects, but that he believes the Chinese government knows what it's doing in terms of managing growth. Australian resource companies will be eagerly watching out for the details of a Chinese stimulus package, which now seems almost certainly on the way.
Japan says it's committed to launching a risk insurance scheme to protect Asia-Pacific states against natural disasters. The commitment was made during the Pacific Alliance leaders meeting in Japan, which also focused on maritime security issues for the very first time. And it comes amid recent territorial disputes in the South China Sea between Japan and China. Garish Sarawani speaks to Australia's Parliamentary Secretary for the Pacific Affairs, Richard Marlis.
Keen to maintain the diplomatic ties built up over the past few decades, Japan pledged to maintain its foreign aid funding to the Pacific Islands of $500 million over the next 3 years. Tokyo has also committed to launching a natural disaster risk insurance scheme to help the Pacific region deal with future emergencies and the impacts of climate change. The Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihiko Noda has also called for emergency donor countries such as China to enhance transparency in their aid. This comes as several Pacific Island states are heavily indebted to China through loans for development. Japan has also raised maritime security for the first time at the summit, as it remains at loggerheads with China over the sovereignty of a group of islands in the South China Sea. Australia's Parliamentary Secretary for Pacific Island and Foreign Affairs, Richard Marles, was at the forum in Okinawa. He says Japan's ongoing engagement with the Pacific is pivotal.
We were very appreciative of the role that Japan is playing in the Pacific. Japan is one of the major donor countries into the Pacific, and we're increasingly building our partnership with Japan in the way in which that development assistance is being delivered. I think it's also fair to say that, in my observation, really this meeting represented a high watermark in the relationship between Japan and the countries of the Pacific. And I think that there was a great sense of appreciation, not only with the amount that's being contributed by Japan, but also the degree of consultation and partnership that is going along with that. And of course, that's very much in line with the way in which we like to see development assistance being done. That is being done in a cooperative way, in a way which empowers the countries who are the recipients of the money, in a way which coordinates with the other donor countries like ourselves, and in a way which is consistent with the Cairns Compact framework.
Speaking about foreign aid, the Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihiko Noda directly called for emerging donors, including China, to enhance the transparency of their aid. Is Australia on board with such a proposal? And is there a sense that China's moves into the Pacific, significantly increasing aid to the region, is putting island nations at an awkward diplomatic position?
I wouldn't agree with the last proposition. So let me be clear about this. China's increased presence in the Pacific is fundamentally welcomed by Australia. The Pacific is a difficult place in which to do development assistance work. I made the point at PALM that as we lead into 2015, when the report card on the Millennium Development Goals will come out, it will be a very patchy result for the Pacific, and I think that's a reflection of the difficulty associated with trying to see societies of small populations in very geographically isolated situations, which is what you're talking about with the Pacific Island countries, experiencing the kind of development that we would all want to see. So with that in mind, if there is any country out there who wants to lend a hand in the development assistance work of the region, we think that is fundamentally a good thing. The one thing that we have consistently asked of any country wanting to participate in the Pacific is that they do so in coordination with the rest of us.
Now, Japan has also committed to launching a natural disaster risk insurance scheme alongside other measures such as improving early warning systems. Obviously, this comes on the back of the recent disasters to strike Japan. Would such a scheme work in the Pacific, and is it something Australia could consider with Japan?
The Pacific, and more generally the world, has much to learn from the enormous tragedy that occurred in Japan. So we very much respect the effort of Japan to try and share their learnings and their experience from that earthquake with the rest of the Pacific. And as we know, the Pacific is a place which is prone to natural disaster.
Now, maritime security was on the agenda for the first time, I believe, and it too coincides with Washington's presence. Was there a sense of concern over China's movements in the South China Sea, which Japan had raised, and that it could somehow flow down further south to the Pacific?
No, that wasn't the issue at PALM at all. But you are right in the presence of America being there and maritime security being an important part of PALM, but that's very much in the context of this. The exclusive economic zones of the countries of the Pacific, for many of them, represents their most important economic asset. Being able to have appropriate maritime security, you know, principally in relation to the prevention of illegal fishing, is quite central to ensuring that these countries get the economic return that is owed to them from their natural resource. And what we're talking about in terms of this maritime security is really ways in which we can see more security put in place, but perhaps as importantly, a better coordination of the efforts of all the players within the region who have assets which have the capacity to engage in security. And so again, this is a welcome intervention on the part of Japan to assist in maritime security in the region, and having America there, I think, was really a really important step because they obviously have much to offer in terms of the assets that they have available to them.
And finally, in East Timor, where youth unemployment is a major problem, the role of sport, in particular football, is seen as increasingly important. Last weekend, a street tournament organized by some recent university graduates took place outside Government Palace. The aim was to give young people an alternative to drugs, alcohol, and violence. Helen Hoffman has more.
Night is falling over East Timor's capital, Dili, and the final preparations for tonight's street soccer tournament are wrapping up.
Go, there's go.
A small, caged soccer pitch and a stage have been set up in front of the majestic Government Palace. and a curious crowd is starting to stroll up from the waterfront.
Oh, mic! Mas Ranto, mic untuk penyanyi, Mas Ranto.
Armed with a clipboard, 22-year-old Grace Gunawan is overseeing the finishing touches. This is the culmination of 3 months of hard work for Grace and her two friends who created the event organization business Plus One.
Plus One, we already did a concert last year, and now this is our activity this year is LA Street Soccer. LA Street Soccer is one entertainment sport, so this is a mix between sport and music. So we play in the cage, and then we play depend on the music. So the players will play in one part, two part, and one part will be two songs.
12 teams have signed up for tonight's tournament. Anya Sousa Fernandez, along with Grace, is master of ceremony and tasked with calling them onto the pitch.
Well, this is very important because, as we know, in Timor-Leste, there's many youth, young people that they don't have job. They don't do some fun stuff, from my perspective. So this kind of sports, this kind of event, it's very fun to do, and it makes you forget about things that usually in here, the mentality of the young Timorese, it's not that they like to make problems, but when they like to hang out, they start to drinking, you know, and, you know, to get this this mentality of like drinking and then start to making problems and all this stuff.
And just as the last match is about to begin, an unexpected guest arrives. East Timor's Prime Minister, Xanana Gusmão, wearing a red Timor-Leste soccer jersey. He makes his way through the crowd, shakes hands with the players, and then takes a front seat to watch the closing game.
To encourage our youth to look at entertainment. It is good for the spirit. We achieved a good environment of peace and stability. Now we are giving to our youth to see that we can take all the opportunities to enjoy, for this to motivate them, to encourage them.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. Once again, our email address is pcj@pcjmedia.com. So on behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell wishing you well, and we'll see you again in 7 days' time. Bye for now.